Hello and welcome to the Keyboard Chronicles, a podcast for keyboard players. I'm your host, David Holloway, and I'm excited as always to be here with you. Paul Bindig, happy new year to you, sir.
Happy new year to you, David. And we're have you got a resolution?
To survive another year of this podcast. What about you?
Fair enough. Look, my resolution is to try and be on more of the podcasts, but looking at my schedule...
I'm not sure.
But great to be here as always, of course.
No, look, it's great to have you here. And we're very excited to introduce our guest for this episode, Mr. Damon McMahon. So as you'll hear when we speak with Damon, he's had an amazing career playing throughout Southeast Asia and Asia more broadly. And we talk about his amazing experience that, but also he's worked for three of the big manufacturers, so Roland, Casio and Yamaha. So we talk a little bit about that and his perceptions of the differences in them as companies and their products. It's a really fascinating discussion, Paul.
Yeah, Damon's a really interesting guy and has had, I would say, a fairly unique musical career path and really combining that really interesting Asian gigging experience, as you were talking about, David, but then also that behind-the-scenes knowledge of from an R&D and a manufacturing perspective. And I know you'll all find this really interesting because I certainly did.
Yeah, absolutely. So here we go. Enjoy our discussion with Damon and we'll talk to you after the show. Damon, absolute pleasure to have you on the show, sir. How are you doing?
Likewise. Very well. Thank you, David and Paul. Good to see you both.
And so we joked just before we started recording about this being a local derby with three Australians and how many times we can work the word mate into the chat. So let's see how we go with that. So David, yeah, it's great to have you here. One of the reasons I was keen to get you on is you have this amazing hybrid career in music of both performing throughout Asia and Southeast Asia in particular, and working for two of the major manufacturers that most of us that on this show and listen and watch us use some of their technology. So I think it's a fascinating sort of hybrid, but I'd like to start off with your performance career. So tell us about how you ended up playing a range of countries through Southeast Asia and more specifically in sort of five-star hotels on contract, because I have no idea how that works.
Got it. Okay. So I think I'd... finished about 5.5 years with Yamaha Music Australia, and decided I didn't want to go straight into another sales / corporate career. A friend had a mate who was a agent that was booking acts over in Asia. Thought, let's do that. My girlfriend at the time was a singer, and we'd been performing as a duo, so put a bit of material together, as in photos and recorded music stuff. Sent that off, got the contract, went to Shanghai, China. And this was, when was this? Late 80s, I think it was. Yeah. Sorry, early 90s. And ended up there as a duo, met another duo. We're at the Portman Shangri-La as a duo in Shanghai. There was another duo with a Kiwi guy and an Aussie girl performing at the Shanghai Hilton at the time. Back in those days, there was literally about 500 or 600 West expats in Shanghai. It was very different. And so we, of course, got to know them, became great friends, saw there was a market for a four-piece band. So the ABBA kind of thing, the pretty girls out the front, the ugly boys up the back on instruments. And put together, again, some more marketing material and sent that off to five-star hotels directly. Didn't go through any agents and managed from there. Off we went.
That's amazing. And so, I mean, you mentioned things were very different back then. Talk about Shanghai in the early 90s, because as we know, over the last 20 to 30 years, with varying levels of transparency, there's been, China has opened up a lot to the world and there are some incredible industries and other areas going on in China. So what was it like in the early 90s?
Look, we were there during an amazing time because, we're there for a 6-month contract, so we were there through the Chinese New Year, which in the second largest city in China is something to behold. It literally was like the Gulf War, the amount of fireworks flying all across the city sky. Buildings were catching on fire because people were letting off fireworks inside. And then the other major event that happened was the floating of the yuan. So at that stage, China had the renminbi and the yuan, two currencies. They floated the renminbi correction. And also I think their leader at the time passed away. So there was quite a lot of stuff happening in the country. We were followed by the PSB, the Public Security Bureau, from time to time, never in a threatening way, just to monitor that we weren't being subversive or disrespectful to the Chinese culture. And we had a mix of expats from all walk of life that would, you know, attend our gigs, you know, in the bars, and to locals as well that would come in, and got to know a lot of people and started this amazing expat life that ended up lasting about 4.5 years.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this was the first stop of many. So tell us about how you progressed from, I assume it was just a matter of you had the runs on the board as far as performing there, and then you progressed to other countries?
Yeah, exactly. And look, I suppose once you've started in a market, and the entertainment market in Asia is certainly that, a market, and you're established, you immediately have some credibility if you're in a 5-star hotel. And back in those days, we didn't even have access to CDs, so we put together a tape with some overdubs by a couple of expat British guys that were doing DJ work in Shanghai. They did some great overdubbed verbal recommendations, I suppose, for us. And we put that onto a tape with a nice photo and really targeted it towards food and beverage managers that were doing the hiring in other countries and hotels. Sent that to them, and the next stop was Singapore, and that was our very first as a four-piece band. And I remember they say in Shanghai there is communism, but you have freedom. In Singapore, it's a democracy, but like the rest to your imagination. And and that was very true. It was quite a brain adjustment to get used to the changes there. And on it went from Singapore. We were there for 6 months. Then we went to Japan, supposed to be 6 months, ended up being 2.5 years. Wow. At the Osaka Hilton, which was incredible. Then finished in Thailand at the, forget the name of the hotel now. I just decided then it was time for me personally to lay down my roots back in Australia and get back into a real job, so a corporate career and a bit of music as well. So. Yeah,
and we're definitely going to talk about that as well. So just going back to Osaka, I know you had some interesting experiences there, including one very fateful night, tragic night. So tell us about the earthquake and your involvement and what you saw go down at that stage.
Yeah, talk about kicking off our post in Japan with a bang. In fact, it was more like an explosion. So we played the first night on the 35th floor Sky Lounge at the Osaka Hilton, where we were contracted. I think the other guy in the band, Gavin, and myself got back to our respective rooms at 4 something in the morning after we completely re-EQ'd the sound system after the first night. And at 5:46 a.m., I'll never forget the time, the Kobe earthquake struck, which is probably, to give people an idea, Sydney to Parramatta distance, around about 25, 30 kilometres. And that killed, that was called the Great Hanshin Earthquake, and that killed about 7,000-odd people immediately, and that number increased with injuries and illnesses later on. It was so violent. We're on the 11th floor of the Osaka Hilton that you couldn't sit up in bed. It was a completely blacked out room, of course. I was dead asleep. I thought someone had broken into the room in my dead sleep and was attacking myself and my partner. She woke up in a mad panic, and you couldn't sit up in bed. It was shaking around and being thrown around the room so hard. All the glasses were falling out of the minibar cabinet, smashing on the floor. Later on, after everything calmed down, some of the aftershocks had finished. Gavin and I went upstairs, 35 flights of stairs, looking out through the glass window of the fire escape stairs to flames and gosh knows what in the distance, and got up to find the 6'3" grand piano had been thrown off the stage and onto the dance floor. Wow. They weigh around about 500 or 600 kilograms. Our speakers that were on poles had gone over. My keyboard rack had gone over. Miraculously, we could have played that night if we'd needed to. I only had 2 or 3 broken keys, but there was no entertainment for a week out of respect for the deceased and the injured. And at that point, Roland Japan, through my contacts from my Australian background, stepped in, helped repair my gear, And that started off a great association with them in Japan and internationally, actually. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, very, very frightening experience.
Absolutely. And so I'm really fascinated, Damon, just on your experience across those four countries. And I'm always a little bit bemused outside of our region. And I know there's even contention about whether Australia is part of Asia. And that's, you know, there are debates around that. But I certainly believe we're a key part of the Asian, particularly the Southeast Asian region. But just what was your experience over those years? What did you learn as both a player and a human about playing across those four countries and the differences you experienced and, you know, just the pure diversity of what you were doing?
Yeah, look, I would say in particular Japan, the as a generalisation, their population has the most astounding, I would call it, developed and mature taste in music. They're huge fans of R&B and contemporary jazz and funk. They have an appreciation and respect that a lot of the broader populations of Western countries just don't seem to have. And that was really quite humbling with their expression of respect for us as performers. And whether we were doing some of our originals as instrumentals that we tend to do earlier in the evening to doing all the pop cover hits from and jazz and Latin and everything else you have to do in a five-star hotel gig, the respect and appreciation we got from Japanese audiences in particular was amazing. And then I suppose being in five-star hotels, again, as I touched on, the breadth of walks of life that people come from in the audience, everything from backpackers that are treating themselves for a luxury night before they go back on the road, to flight crew, to business people, to locals, and everything in between. It's one thing I really learned is that we needed to keep in mind as entertainers is it's about the audience, and we really need, because we are there to provide their entertainment, and we weren't original bands, so we were performing essentially what would please the audience and get them spending on food and beverage, to be perfectly frank, when you boil it down from a business perspective. So being flexible, having an updated repertoire, and being able quite often to do requests on the spot, which include having vocals down for singers, not just, you know, as musicians being able to play the chords and the grooves and all that kind of stuff. So
I'm actually, as an extension of that, just fascinated with the idea that when you started out in Shanghai, you were, you know, doing a male and female duo, which became an ABBA project. And my mindset is that that would seem to be an unlikely thing to ignite and inspire the people of China. But obviously I'm wrong.
Yeah, look, I suppose we went to a four-piece in our next contract, which was in Singapore. But look, again, it's a business and a market, and it comes down to what budgets the hotel have for entertainment, but also what value they believe they can derive from it. At the end of the day, entertainment is actually a function of revenue generation for hotels. So keeping that in mind, I guess having a business marketing background also really helped in focus and shape that to meet the market.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Damon, you mentioned just before about that that tragic earthquake that happened while you were in Osaka, and what came out of the back of that was a deepening relationship with Roland. I'm wondering if you can share with us a little bit of your time with Roland, working with them and the consultancy work you did with them.
Yes, so I had done a tiny little bit of consulting on a project or two that was non-customer, as in retailer, if you like, focused in Australia before I left, just in a, you know, part-time couple of projects, recruiting and training some staff and that sort of thing. Went to Asia, moved to Japan, and when contacted them, they were delighted to have some expats living in what was then Roland Corporation's global headquarters in Osaka. Very shortly after that, they moved to Hamamatsu, which is where their global facility is now, on a beautiful lake with an R&D facility to die for and everything else. But it started out, I think originally started typing and writing new product brochures and catalogues. So they would give what I would call a jinguish, so a, you know, Japanese English, poor English sort of broad description and a table of accurate specifications. And probably who the target market for these products were, whether they were sound modules, synthesizers, drum machines, hard disk recording, effects, guitar, all that sort of stuff. And ended up writing a few brochures and catalogs for them. And then they started bringing us some prototypes after we'd signed an NDA. And we were working on prototypes in our hotel rooms, doing some testing, some development, tweaking of sounds, adding features. And that also included a couple of trips to Hamamatsu on our one night off a week to their R&D facility, work with engineers on some of the bigger projects. And it also ended up with us having some disguised prototypes in shells that had no markings on it, had a black cloth to drop over the top of the products in between sets so that, you know, people couldn't see. And one of those, I think, was the RD600, an absolute standard in stage pianos even now. Another one was the Roland G-Series Arranger workstation. The V drums were just being finalized at that time. I remember Gavin, amazingly talented guy, the other guy in the band, and myself were working on that and the response of the Remo mesh head for the snare and how that tracked from a sound perspective. We record that into a hard disk drive and then work with the engineers on refining some of that. It was amazing. Yeah, it was really great fun. And to be able to work with products that weren't quite released and, in fact, still had glitches and things, work around those in between sets was a lot of fun.
That was actually going to be my next question, Damon, was did any interesting little glitches in the beta models of these prototypes cause you a few dramas when you were playing live?
Look, I'm sure there were, but we probably avoided running them in full flight. So if it was a synth or an arranger workstation, might have just been using sounds, or perhaps with split keyboard, perhaps bass in the left hand, Rhodes in the right, or layering a couple of sounds in the right, maybe running a drum groove and working through the variations of the drum pattern, but not running full sequences or not running full left hand groove accompaniment patterns, and to avoid, you know, stressing the processor too much and perhaps putting ourselves in that position. So there wasn't anything major that happened, not at least not unrecoverable, that ended up being a train wreck, which I know we'll probably talk about later on.
Well, we most certainly will. We most certainly will. is there anything we could look at, say, in the finished, for example, Roland RD600 and Damon McMahon go, you know what, that happened because of the feedback I gave them? Is there something that you can sort of proudly say that was a result of our work?
Yeah, look, a very, very simple addition was the RD600, if I remember rightly, had some really great organ patches on it, but not the ability to switch between slow and fast Leslie tremolo speed. So I think we had that added in only for certain samples, because some of them were preset organ rotary speed tremolo. And the other one was, I think, being able to start and stop drum grooves. I think, if I remember rightly, it had some preset basic drum patterns, more for practice purposes and that sort of thing. And you could start and stop that with a foot switch, which you previously couldn't do, which for a pianist, a keyboard using two hands, is pretty well essential. So just a very simple thing like that, yeah.
Oh, amazing. Congratulations.
My claim to fame.
Yeah, absolutely. Take it all away. That's amazing. Damon, you were telling us before about how humbled you were by the I'll use the word knowledgeability, music knowledgeability of the Japanese music fans. And maybe you could share with us some of your experience meeting some of your music heroes at the Osaka Blue Note Jazz Club, and who I believe may have even jammed with you as well.
Yeah, exactly. So the Osaka Blue Note Jazz Club is one of about five or six Blue Note Jazz Clubs around Japan. And it was literally around the corner from the Osaka Hilton. And mainly American artists would come and do a circuit touring Japan, doing the five or six Blue Note Jazz Clubs. And a lot of these names, guys like Joe Sample, probably, if you ask me, my keyboard hero, it would be Joe Sample, and his band, when he launched his album and did a tour of Japan called Did You Feel That? And he wrote it in tribute to the California earthquake, which happened actually a year before. So we got to meet Joe and literally hang out with him, had drinks with him. He'd, to an extent, probably pontificate. He was quite a deep thinker, Joe, and he'd talk about books he was reading and about the state of music industry today. He came to Australia while we happened to be back on a short break. He gave us front row seats to his concert, even gave us a shout out, you know, at one stage in the audience, which for any piano player is an absolute thrill. And I remember Joe walking into the gig, and the first set was normally instrumental, which Gavin Hamburger, my amazing partner in the band, musically, and I would do as instrumental, and then the girls would come on for the second, third, fourth sets. And he and I were doing our instrumentals, sort of a smooth jazz style, quite a lot of those were originals. And I looked up and said across quietly off mic to Gavin, "Is that, you know, wanting Joe sample?" And he looked up and we both nearly died. That's, you know, and I think we actually took an unscheduled short break then just to recover. And he ended up being a lovely man, incredibly gracious. Other music heroes were the original members of Blues Brothers, Steve Cropper on guitar, Lou Marini on sax, Patches Stewart, I think I was on trumpet. A bunch of those sorts of guys. We had Patty Austin come in with her band. That was a very funny story. Because they were touring Japan, they were on the road for quite a few weeks, they'd get quite homesick. And probably if they were in a Western country like Australia or America or anywhere else, they probably wouldn't tend to give you the time of day. But they'd finish their gig quite often, we were still going, and in their hotel room, they'd come up and hang out with us, and some of them got on stage. We had Steve Gadd playing percussion on congas and bongos with us on stage jamming. He was just the loveliest man and so approachable. We had Ricky Lawson. Remember, had quite a few beers with Ricky Lawson, who's he recorded the original drum introduction to Anita Baker's having a mental blank now. We can fill it in later, but on drums, and he was a drummer for Michael Jackson and Phil Collins, one of the best in the world. Remember having quite a few beers with him. We all jumped on the bikes, the push bikes that we had, and rode down to Osaka Blues & Co., this little smoky jazz club down the south side of Osaka. And he jumped on the old drum kit there. Made it sound incredible. That was probably like, you know, hitting tin cans together. And Gavin on guitar, myself on piano, and jammed together. It's just a thrill I'll never forget. And just George Benson was there, gave us a bit of a wave from far away. We sat down and had a drink with Nathan East, one of the greatest session bass players in the world, and his lovely wife. They were newlyweds. He signed my bass guitar that I've still got. So, yeah, a lot of fantastic, very fun memories.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Osaka sounded like a golden period for you, Damon, because I know you also did some gigs on behalf of the Australian consulate. Tell us about that, including some great punter behavior in the middle of gigs, people trying to come up while you're playing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, look, from memory, I think it was the opening of the new consulate in Osaka, Japan, or might have been the Trade Commission. And they were showing off Australian building capabilities as part of the new building they released. And being an Australian band and local, they knew of us. So the consulate got in touch and said, "Would you guys come and play? We'll transport you there during the day. Won't interrupt your evening thing. Have you back in time." But great, yep. And a particular federal minister, member of parliament, came up, and in the middle of us performing, broad daylight, sunny, looking out over Osaka, and he walks up literally right in our faces and says, "Hi, I won't say his name, I'm blah, 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 oh. Pleased to meet you." And the girls are trying to sing with a microphone. Gavin's on guitar or sax, whatever. I'm on keyboards. And I just looked at him and started laughing and just kept playing. And I think the girls graciously shook his hand, but Gavin and I just sort of laughed. And, yeah, so politicians, got to love them.
I think, and look, I've decided, I don't expect you to confirm or deny this, and I'm just going to say it's true, even if it's a lie. It must have been Anthony Albanese as a music fan, and he's now our Prime Minister, so I'm choosing to believe it was him. That's what I'm going with.
We'll get the name of the politician offline later.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely. In fact, I don't believe he's with us any longer. So.
Oh, okay. Oh, now you're going to have me thinking. Yeah, we'll talk after the show. And so right. You've talked about some of your amazing work with Roland, and you did mention it at the start of the show. So was your first major manufacturer Yamaha, then Roland, and then Casio?
Correct, yes. So I worked for Yamaha Music Australia in my 20s as the role was called promotions manager and a product specialist. So I was doing clinics and demonstrations on Yamaha products, Clavinova, portable keyboards, since that kind of thing, all over Australia, and also managing the tours of Japanese artists that would come out from Yamaha Japan. And that started my love affair with the Japanese people, really getting to know Japanese staff. Then I went overseas for 4.5 years and had deep involvement with Roland Japan at so many levels. Whilst I was in Japan and Osaka, I started taking lessons in Japanese and studied it under a sensei, a teacher. And by the time we left Japan, 2.5 years later, was getting fairly conversational in Japanese. And those now very rudimentary Japanese skills really stayed with me all through my career, especially from a business, which was intertwined with music. Coming back to Australia, I joined Roland for nearly 10 years, managing their contemporary keyboards division, which is portable keyboards, digital pianos, a range of products, those sorts of things. Then I left and went to two other Japanese companies in the consumer products side of it. And then in the 2011, I joined the company in Australia that distribute Casio and managed the business for Casio EMI, electronic musical instruments, for, again, close to nearly 10 years before I left the industry. Wow. So that Japanese background and music background combined with business has just been a real blessing for me to be able to combine my passion for both music and business and Japan, in fact, all through my career, which has been just fantastic. Very blessed.
Absolutely. And so I'm fascinated, without talking out of school too much, just across those three manufacturers, Damon, what were your impressions, or what did you learn from each of those companies as far as how similar or different they were? They're all highly successful companies, and I'm personally chuffed to see, I know you don't work for Casio or EMI anymore, but I'm just thrilled to see Casio having a real renaissance, because they copped a lot of flack for many years and illegitimately has been sort of the toy manufacturer or the lesser of the manufacturers, and they're certainly coming into their own again, deservedly so. But just interested in your impressions of the three within the constraints of what you can say.
Great question, actually, David. One of the observations I'd make is that Roland were, and largely still are, though they're diversified a little bit, very, very focused music business, music company. And when I was involved with them back all through the 90s and into the 2000s, when I was back here in Australia, that music focus was amazing. And they had incredible resources, I guess, given they make everything from little Johnny's first keyboard to an extent up to the most eponymous instruments used by the top professional musicians all around the world in studios, live work, wherever. Their resources were pretty impressive. And I spent a lot of time both in Japan and Australia with them. So I got to, I suppose, be exposed to a fair bit of the culture, the people, in other words. Casio being a computer company, first and foremost, and one of their divisions, what they do is music, I guess, is impressive to me because they need to do more with less. So they perhaps don't have some guitar R&D guys that might be able to contribute to sampling or how to program particular guitar parts in for keyboard use, or just as one example. So it was really impressive, a much smaller team, and how open they were to having outsiders, foreigners, non-Japanese, involved in their R&D and market research efforts. Very different. It was a music division within a very large computer company with Casio, and therefore a very different culture, very different approach, and some restrictions as well as some strength that brought, as opposed to the likes of Yamaha and Roland that were very, very focused and large music giants. So, and I would comment that Casio, of course, just in our tiny country by global standards, Australia, sell tens of thousands of keyboards alone, let alone digital pianos, since that kind of gear, every year. So, every second person you speak to has a Casio keyboard that was their first keyboard as a kid, Mine actually was a little Yamaha keyboard just by chance when I was a boy that my parents first bought for me. But everyone had one, and maybe still, you know, covered in dust under the bed or sitting somewhere not used, or being used in stages and studios around the world. So they do unfairly have perhaps a stamp of being a Wally box, as we would call them in Australia, or just a toy, a music toy. But yeah, they're an amazing brand, as are Roland and Yamaha, and with so much to offer. Yeah,
you got me thinking about my very, very first toy keyboard as a boy, and it was a Yamaha PSS, one of the Porter Sound System with miniature keys. So I was just having some fond memories of that, Damon.
Absolutely, of course. Yeah, mine was a Yamaha PS20, which with full size keys, 4 octaves, and
nice.
Used to put the rhythms on that through a little powered speaker, and then play acoustic piano to it. So yeah, that was my first drumming experience.
Oh, fantastic.
I'm older than both of you. I had a Yamaha Electone organ that we bought off family friends.
Oh, wow. Well,
it's all Yamaha.
Yes.
Oh, we're straight on Yamaha. Yeah. How cool. Damon, just reflecting on your extensive experience from the business side of things and the R&D side of things with those three music companies, and also your very extensive live performance experience, I'm really fascinated as to what are your, or what have been through your musical journey, your favourite keyboards to play from a live performance perspective, and why. And I think your insight will be valuable, given you have probably a more intimate knowledge of what goes on behind the scenes with the manufacture of some of these than most of us would.
Yeah, sure. Look, my go-to for a 88 note weighted, you know, piano, stage piano, and also a very effective controller is a model by Casio called the PX5S. It's actually probably off camera, but it's behind me, this white keyboard there. I don't know if you can see that, but it's a 88 note stage piano. It has an amazing action with, just personally, from my taste, the depth of the action is astounding, especially given this thing only weighs about 10 or 11 kilos. You can literally carry one in each arm without a problem, you know, a carry case. It's, you know, things like 256 voice polyphony. It has a fully editable synth on board, foot controllers as well, which are completely assignable, and sound quality that you could definitely use in any recording. So it's so light and compact. It's supremely portable, I suppose. And so I really like that, and I like the action. I've recently just become a very new, brand new Korg fan. This is a PA5X. Which again is an arranger type keyboard. There's a 76 note semi weighted waterfall action, and below that is a probably its 20 year old equivalent from Roland. I can't see if you can see that on camera, but this is a Roland G70, which was the last of the arranger workstations they made. Had a lot of the XV series and Phantom sounds on board. Still holds up today. Again, it's 76 note semi weighted waterfall action. They're both very different. I was astounded at just how far the sound quality and the mastering and EQ has come in the Korg that I've just bought a few months ago from the Roland. But having owned a keyboard for 20 years, you know it inside out, right? So I can just work, my workflow is just so fast on this. And even if I'm just midiing out to the newer instrument, sometimes I'll just stick with that. So.
Yeah, no, great. And so let's talk arrangers for a minute, because they, as you know, amongst the professional community, they sometimes, not all the time, but there can be a little bit of snobbery towards arranger keyboards. And I know just with the recent release of the Genos 2 Yamaha, I've watched videos on that, and it's like, I would kill for one of those keyboards, aside from the fact it's over 7,000 Australian dollars, which I obviously can't afford. But just, you, I'm assuming your current musical work, Damon, is still a lot of duo or trio work, to which, to me, these keyboards would seem to be perfect.
Yeah, they are. And look, there's not always a budget for a drummer and a bassist and a whole rhythm section in a band, right? Or there might not be the space, or perhaps it's... But for whatever reason, all sorts of reasons that you can't have a whole band. We'd all, of course, love to play with live musicians all of the time. But I guess it's something that I've developed since as a boy. I've always been fascinated with left-hand bass, which started with boogie piano, walking bass lines and things like that. And that developed developed into, you know, left-hand bass kind of work. And as a duo, trio, perhaps, where there's not a drummer, it's just, you know, a singer and a guitarist, keyboards or something like that, the bass and the drums and a lot of that rhythm section kind of stuff, even how you play road sounds and things, as part of the rhythm section, falls to the keyboardist. And so, you know, with a range of keyboard patterns now, even from, you know, 20 years ago to the very latest, the rhythm programming and the controllability, the flexibility that gives you to control drum patterns and grooves live, you know, for a lot of cases, I'd like to do a blindfold test for even trained musicians and see whether they can tell whether parts of things are a live drummer or a recorded drum track being played along to, or an arranger keyboard. They are that good. And of course you can edit them and which I do a lot of my work on, and to tune it exactly how you want it, whether it be, you know, editing the snare sound or, you know, where it falls within a groove, all that kind of deal. But arranger patterns, they also, aside from a professional side of it, which there is a fair bit of snobbery, as you nicely put it, I think, for them, they're editable synths as well, and they just give you so much flexibility, especially for live work where there's not always a budget or the practicality for a live band. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's what's really taken me aback in recent years, and I'm sure it's been the case for a long while, just the quality of the preset synth and piano and organ sounds that would, yeah, they hold up against all the major standalone synths and organs. So yeah, I think it's great.
They do, and those major brands also, they've converged. They used to have a separate team and separate sound engines for the home type keyboards, including arranger keyboards, and then they had the pro section, but that technology is now just completely converged. So, you know, a lot of Korg's latest sounds from their Chrome and series synths, they're just literally what are in this PA5X, and the Roland, even back 20 years ago, it's a lot of the Phantom sounds, even though it's a Ranger keyboard. So it's not as if they're second rate sounds. Same with Casio stuff. They're just pro grade sounds. So yeah.
That's right. Now, you mentioned before about train wrecks, Damon, and we are coming to that part of the show. So I'd love it if it was a Ranger keyboard related, but anyway, is there something where something's gone spectacularly wrong over the last 20 to 30 years with a gig that you can look back upon and laugh now?
Look, I suppose the Federal Minister of Member of Parliament, you know, trying to shake our hands in the middle of a performance, literally.
Anthony Albanese.
It was not our current Prime Minister, no.
No, I know.
But that was quite a funny one. It didn't train wreck the performance, but yeah, the girls got the giggles, of course, and we all did, but... probably nothing to do with the Ranger keyboards. It was at the Basement in Sydney, actually. It was a fairly high-profile gig, which I think we did over two nights. I won't say, you know, which material or which band or which artist, but the guitarist, who is absolutely studio quality, huge respect and love playing with him, his guitar gradually and increasingly just went further and further out of tune. But over the space of two sets, and he didn't notice. And because it was so gradual, most of us are going, what is it? And in the end, in the break, we took longer to put new strings on and restring the guitar and getting back on stage. And look, it wasn't a train wreck. It didn't seem to affect anyone out of the audience. But when you listen back to the recordings that I have, it's just a real shame, because half of the recordings, at least maybe three quarters, are just increasingly big. You just can't listen to it. It's just... So grating against the ear. So I'll call that a train wreck, even though it didn't affect the audience. So.
Nicely described, and well done in just preserving the honour of the guitarist in question too.
We've all been there in some form, right? So.
Oh, totally. I've done way worse things than that on stage, I can assure you. we always ask our guests, Damon, if they would love to suggest a keyboard player that they could tag, in the sense that we might approach them to interview them, someone that you might admire and you would love to learn more about to be interviewed on the podcast. Have you got any suggestions for us?
And Damon, just to add to that, I'd like to call out a huge thanks to Damon. Damon's actually already, I forgot to mention this to you, Paul, tagged someone, put me in touch with them, and I won't give away the name at this stage. So, but Damon, on top of that person,
do it again.
You could think of just anyone else. Yeah.
Look, there is. He is one of the founding members of Earth, Wind and Fire. He's... he's the keyboard player and composed two or three of their biggest hits. He's still performing, based in LA, West Coast of America. I've actually already reached out to him, a little message, and waiting to hear back from him to see whether he'd be interested to come on board. Out of respect for his own privacy, I'll wait until he responds and then we can go from there. So, yeah. But he, no, my gosh, you know, being able to say in your resume, oh yeah, I wrote some of Earth, Wind & Fire's biggest songs on, and I'm a keyboard player. It's,
wow.
Yeah. Enough said, right?
Absolutely. I'd also like to publicly thank you for the other one that you've put us in touch with as well, because as you'll hear, listeners and viewers, once we do this interview, this other person has had a stunning career.
Amazing.
As well.
Grammy Awards. So and is a true gentleman as well.
It's just amazing. So, and our other standard question, Damon, is the dreaded Desert Island Discs question. Five albums, if you had to choose them, what would they be?
Sure. Not necessarily in this order, but one that has had a huge effect on me musically and starting in Australia is actually what I'm sure you guys wouldn't have heard it. And it's called Here Come Da, as in D-A, Boogeyman. And it's by an Australian pianist who's no longer with us, unfortunately, called Herbie Marx. And I think he played accordion as well as harmonium, but he was an incredible boogie pianist. And growing up in my teens, I would beg mum and dad to take me to RSL clubs and things where he was playing around Sydney. Back in those days, you couldn't take kids there for that sort of thing, so they bought me a record of his instead. If I thought of it, I would have held the album up, but because it's no longer in print, of course. But I recently, just a year ago, purely by chance, was sitting with some friends and spoke, and they said, oh, what's your background, where did you come from? And it's, I said, well, I learned all about boogie piano from this Australian called Herbie Marx. And they said, we're friends with his son, he lives in Katoomba. So I'll give a shout out to Len Marx, who sent me a beautiful photo of his dad Herbie in the studio back in the 70s, I think it was.
That's amazing.
And I learned so much piano from that. So Here Come to Boogie Man by Herbie Marx, hugely, arguably the most influential on me musically. Another one would be Al Jarreau. So Jarreau, self-titled album, which was released, I think, in 83. Guys like, you know, Steve Gadd and Jeff Beccaro on various drum tracks. David Foster on a lot of the keyboard stuff, including that amazing solo in Mornin' on the song Mornin' on, I think it Sounds Like a Moog or something, solo is incredible. Jay Graydon on guitar, Jerry Hay and his brass section did a lot of the arrangements of the brass. It was just amazing. Another one, actually back to more boogie and blues piano, is a guy called Johnny Johnson, now also deceased. I was lucky enough to see him at the Roselle Hotel in Sydney back in the 90s, I think it was. And he's got a particular album called Johnny B. Bad. And that harks back with lots of the boogie piano lyrics, licks to some of the original piano tracks that he recorded for Chuck Berry. So again, those just absolutely eponymous boogie blues piano licks. So that whole album is amazing. And he sings in a lot of the tracks on that. So I wish he was still alive. It'd be amazing. Another one would be, actually another Australian theme would be the soundtrack to the movie Rebel. Which was a motion picture movie called, featured Australia's Debbie Byrne, stunning vocalist, absolutely amazing vocalist, and actor Matt Dillon. And it was set in Sydney in World War II. And he was a Marine that went AWOL. And a lot of the soundtrack features Australia's Galapagos Duck, our amazing, you know, signature, I think, jazz rock band, right? Also some arrangements by another deceased gentleman by the name of Ray Cook, who's an incredible piano player but arranger, and he did some beautiful arrangements in that album. A lot of big band, boogie swing, you know, 1942s type era, but then with Galapagos Duck throwing a really modern influence. So if you get a chance, listen to that. You'll be able to stream tracks from it on YouTube. I don't think you can buy the album at all in any formal fashion now. But another one would be Stevie Wonder's Natural Wonder. Twin disc album, a lot of it with live and never before heard live arrangements that went to all sorts of places. So look, I think that's about five albums, I think. So yeah,
it is. Yeah, great picks, brilliant.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much. All right, it's time for the quick fire 10, Damon. I know you know how this works. We've got 10 quick questions, 10 quick answers, And I'm going to kick off with what is the first album you ever heard?
ELO's Time album back in the early 80s.
Great, yeah. The production on those albums is incredible. Your most important pre-gig ritual?
Drinking water.
Yeah, no, it's hydration is very, very important. We definitely agree with that. If you hadn't been a musician, Damon, what other career choice do you think you would
Fighter
have
pilot.
Wow, cool. That is cool. The boy in me goes, cool.
Mine still does.
Yes. Now, given that your love of a range of keyboards, but also your broad career, I'm not sure what your answer will be on this. Transpose button or adjust on the fly?
Prefer adjust on the fly, but to avoid a train wreck, I'll hit transpose button every time.
Cool. I'm really interested in the answer to this question. What's the favorite city you've ever played?
I would say probably Singapore. Might have been to do with the venue that we're in, which was a stunning raised stage with booths all around, but a big dance floor. Is in a 5-star hotel called the Pan Pacific Hotel. Had a great sound. And afterwards, we could walk across through the park to an amazing section of bars with live music and stuff after our gig that was still going. So, a mix of reasons.
There you go. Great
Thank
pick. And favorite gig you've ever done, if you haven't already mentioned it, Damon? So that aside from the one where Anthony Albanese came up, who else?
It would have been at the NAMM show when Roland flew our band, four-piece band Sexuality, from Japan to the United States to perform at the NAMM show and at a bunch of dealer retailer functions and things afterwards. So, yeah, that would be,
And let's briefly talk about that, Damon, and apologies, I missed that point. I did have that to discuss with you. So tell us about, was that your first experience at NAMM?
Yes, it was actually. I hadn't been there before with previous with Yamaha Music Australia, for example. So yeah, that was the first experience at NAMM show. I since visited many times with Roland and Casio, of course. But yeah, performing there as a musician and then at functions and things at the President Nixon Library and things afterwards was just an absolute thrill. And that was because in America, the Arranger workstation keyboards were never really adopted to the extent that they were in Europe and even in Australia. So they wanted to promote the concept of Arranger keyboards as the engine of a band, if you like. And so yeah, through our work there and with the president of Roland America at the time, a lovely man called Dennis Houlihan, who was very much a mentor to me. We negotiated an arrangement to go over and perform there, and it was incredible. And a great team that looked after us, and some very funny stories, one of which I won't put to air here, but perhaps we can cover off on that later.
Excellent. Yeah, look, it's around. By the time this goes there, NAMM will have finished, but it's certainly that NAMM
Coming up,
sort time of
yes.
year, that's for sure.
Yeah, what a way to have your first
Yeah,
experience of NAMM. That's
that's right.
absolutely amazing. Can you name an artist for us, Damon, that you have not worked with, but you would love to work with?
Wow. David Foster comes to mind. An amazing
Yeah.
keyboardist, but what a brilliant, brilliant arranger and composer as well. That would be amazing. He's definitely a musical hero of mine. And to be able to work with him, even just to have 5 minutes, would be incredible.
And incredibly easy to
Oh,
get on with,
yes.
apparently.
Yes, absolutely.
Favorite music documentary or movie, Damon?
The Fabulous Baker Boys, which featured Michelle Pfeiffer as a piano bar singer and Jeff and Beau Bridges as a dueling piano, brothers. And if there's musicians listening that haven't watched this, do it because I'm sure it'll strike chords, pardon the pun, for everyone that sees it. Yeah.
Yeah, I can only endorse that statement, Damon. What a fabulous
Absolutely.
movie that is. Name one thing you would like to see invented that would make your life as a keyboard player easier.
More backpack style keyboard cases. There's a couple of them on the market. And obviously, there's going to be weight restrictions, but it's just so much better for your back instead of lugging stuff like this. And yeah.
Yeah, great one. And then what keeps you sane outside of music, Damon? What's your favourite non-musical activity?
Scuba diving. Being under the water, either snorkeling or scuba diving, I liken it to being a bird flying through an underwater garden. It's just amazing. I was lucky to do a very quick scuba dive trip for about 8 days up to Papua New Guinea in August. And probably the most amazing holiday experiences I've ever had.
Yeah, love the garden analogy. And I think it's fair to say, Damon, you've certainly been through the garden that is Southeast Asia and Asia throughout your amazing musical career to date. Who are you? You're doing still some regular gigs in Australia?
Yeah, look, here and there. There's a bunch of Sydney musicians that all know each other. And, you know, it's a phone call or a text or an email or something. You're free. Here it is. So here and there, the odd gig. Sometimes it's a corporate thing. Recently did a launch for a speaker brand, well-known speaker brand for my current employer. That was great. We had a 12 or 13 piece band on stage with a brass section, the whole thing, and we're doing the bigger production kind of things like, you know, Toto's Rosanna and those kind of tunes, which you don't get to do those every gig, right? So that was great. Yeah, with more speakers than you could imagine. So that was great. The odd gig here and there.
No, that's excellent. Look, no, that's great. Look, we can't thank you enough for having for taking the time with us today. And just to pull back the curtain a bit to our listeners and viewers, Mr. McMahon, he was concerned he wouldn't be an interesting guest, and I assured him repeatedly that he would be, and he's certainly proven that today with his amazing story. So, yeah, cannot thank you enough for taking the time, Damon. It's been an absolute
pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, guys. I really appreciate the opportunity. It's been great fun.
And there we have it. As we said at the start of the show, Paul Damon's a fascinating guy, and he's had some experiences that certainly I know I'll never have.
Yeah, well, just let's just start with scuba diving. That's something that. but yeah, totally. I mean, being near a massive and very very tragic and impactful earthquake, and sort of seeing the results of that was just that in itself is amazing. What a beautiful, rich part of the world Southeast Asia is too. I'm lucky I get to travel there a little bit myself, and it's. But I certainly don't have Damon's vast depth of experience there. But it is a wonderful, beautiful, interesting place. So I feel like he's been really generous in allowing us to come on that journey with him a little bit over the last hour or so we chatted to him.
That's right. Yeah, no, hugely appreciate Damon's time. And as always, we appreciate your time listening. Super quick shout out to our gold and silver sponsors, Tammy Catcher from Tammy's Musical Stew. Thank you, Tammy, as always. We appreciate it. Dave Bryce and the team at musicplayer.com forums. We've been members for over 20 years, or I have, and you have not far off, Paul. Great place to hang out and talk keyboards. And also Mike from midnightmastering.com. Superb mixing and mastering services from a guy that's been doing it for many, many years and does it extremely well. And last but definitely not least, Brother Paul Brown from the Water Boys, and also from an outfit called the Brothers Brown. Literally at time of recording, the Brothers Brown released their latest album, and I had a listen to it last night. Really, really great. Highly recommended. So Brothers Brown, I apologize, I've forgotten the name of the album, but if you look for Brothers Brown on all the major streaming services, it is there, and I highly recommend a listen. That'll do us for this episode. We'll be back again in a week or so, and in the meantime, keep on playing.